This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests, Glenn Hansard and Marketa Erglova, are the stars of the film Once. He plays a Dublin street musician. She plays a young mother and pianist who recently emigrated from the Czech Republic. She befriends him on the street. They start writing and playing songs together and realize their kindred spirits. This low-budget indie film became a big success. Hansard and Erglova won an Oscar this year for Best Original Song, and in the process of making the film, Hansard and Erglova became a couple and a music duo. They perform under the name The Swell Season and are currently on an American tour. Their movie Once is out on DVD. Glenn Hansard is also known for his work in the band The Frames. The writer and director of Once, John Carney, used to be in The Frames. Let's start with the Oscar-winning song from Once. This is Falling Slowly. Glenn Hansard, Marketa Erglova, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the Oscar and all the success you've had with Once. You co-wrote Falling Slowly. Had you ever written a song together before writing for the film?
No, that was actually the first song we wrote together. And it was one of those things where I'd been working on the song and I wasn't really sure where I was going with it. All I had was, you know, was the verse, and I had an idea for the chorus. And it was only when I sat down with Mar and I played her the idea, because I was talking about a harmony in the chorus, and she said, well, what if you take the lower one and or you take the higher one and I'll take the lower one, and you know, on the moment where it goes, we've still got time, and she and it was for me, that was like the key of what made the song suddenly work. And and then so I wrote the chorus with Mar, and then I really felt like we had a solid song in our hand, and it was something that I could give to John and feel confident with.
Glenn, you pointed out that the movie was not written with you in mind as the performer, or with Marketa in mind. Cillian Murphy, who is best known to me through his role in Breakfast on Pluto, was supposed to be the star of the film, but he had to back out at the last minute. So I guess that's how you ended up being cast yourself.
Yeah, I mean, what happened was that Cillian was involved in the project all along, and Cillian likes The Frames, and so he was happy to sing my songs. But I think some of the songs I turned in, I think Cillian probably felt a little bit... Cillian's a great singer, but I think he felt a bit unprepared for some of the... Because the songs that John chose were some of the more dynamically, vocally challenging songs, because I just gave John a bunch of songs and he chose which ones he liked, which ones he didn't. And I think Cillian got a little bit sensitive about, maybe possibly about the idea of singing a few of these songs and being able to sort of do them justice. And I remember making the suggestion that I was like, I'll change the keys, I'll make it work. Because for me, having the job of writing the songs, I just wanted to keep my gig. And so I was like, I'll change the keys, I'll do whatever Cillian needs to in order to make these songs work. And I think possibly what happened was that Cillian just got offered another job and then maybe took it. I think that Cillian had done maybe enough low budget Irish films, even though Once was originally budgeted at about 2 million, which is nowhere near a low budget movie in Ireland. And because Killian's name was attached to it, producers were happy to back the film up. But once Killian pulled out, John was left in a very I guess he was kind of stranded, because the producers pulled out once Killian pulled out, and then suddenly this project, which was about to film in a month or two, suddenly had no money. And this is kind of where things got exciting for us, because John had already cast Mar, Killian had backed out on him, the producers had backed out on him, but he still had a crew booked and he still had a shoot day. And so he had to sort of figure out, do I drop this project and move on to another idea I had, or do I try to make this work somehow? And we all sat down together, because I was involved in the project as a songwriter, we all sat down together and we sort of, I guess we all tried to figure out what to do. And I got really excited about the idea of making the film as cheaply as possible. And it also meant that we could, you know, we figured out how to do it. So we wouldn't use lights. There was talk of originally shooting the film on film. Let's shoot it on DV. And instead of hiring the cameras, let's just buy two cameras. Let's shoot the whole film without permits. Because in Dublin, like in most cities, if you put a tripod on the street, you need to have a permit for it, and therefore you need to have security. And, you know, let's do this whole thing without any of that. Let's just do it all handheld. And let's cut the crew in half so that we don't need, you know, in terms of costume, let's just do all the costumes, or let's just bring our own clothes. Let's just do this thing super, super minimalist.
And let's hire someone real cheap, like Glenn Hansard.
I forgot about that element. Yeah, and let's just get me made to do it. And when John approached me to do it, I was kind of nervous, I must admit. I didn't really like the idea, because I just didn't feel like I could pull it off. But then John kind of put to me, he said, look, no one's going to sing these songs like you do, because you wrote them. He says, I'm forced into the choice of having, you know, two actors who can probably half sing, or two musicians who can half act. And he says, if it's a musical film, I'd rather have two musicians who can half act, and I'll get a performance out of you. And he says, as long as the music's convincing, I think people are going to believe it. So that was kind of his gamble. And he took us on. There was no screen tests. There was no rehearsals. We went into the film on the first day, and John had no idea if we were going to be able to pull it off.
Marquetta, you were cast before Glenn was. How did you get the part? You hadn't acted before.
No, well, John Carney, the director, approached Glenn about this, you know, as you know, about the idea for this film. And throughout the years, they'd met many years in cafes over teas and coffees and discussed the idea of the film. And when the project was getting closer to happening, John said to Glenn, well, you know, the only thing is I have Cillian Murphy for the male part, but I can't find a woman for the female part. I have trouble finding this woman, because I want it to be an Eastern European woman who can sing and play piano and act. And, you know, would you know any people, because you travel a lot? And Glenn said, well, yeah, I know a girl from Czech Republic, and she does play piano and sing, and I'm sure she could pull off the acting, but the thing is, she's only 17, and John was looking for a 35-year-old woman originally. And so John kind of thought that 17 years old was too young, but he decided to meet me anyway. And so I just got on the plane to Dublin from Prague and met John, the director, and just kind of played a few tunes on the piano for him, and that was my audition, really. He didn't get me to read any lines or anything. He just cast me right then and there. And that was it. I was part of the project.
You were 17 when the movie was shot?
Yeah.
Wow, that's right. You don't look it. You really look older in it.
I know, it's funny. Even now people meet me in person and they tell me I look much younger than in the film, and it's ironic because I'm now older than I was in the film, so it's weird. They must have done it. And I wasn't wearing any makeup or anything. I don't know whether it was just the clothes or the camera making me look older. It's a funny thing.
I think it was the fact that you embodied the character of, because I think the character was meant to be like 22 or 23, so Mar embodied that character, and I think maybe it was just believable.
Let's hear another song that you co-wrote together for Once, and this is If You Want Me. And Glenn, why don't you describe how this song is used in the film?
Well, there was one. John wanted to have one song in the film that was basically a throwback or a salute to the classic musical. We decided a couple of things in the beginning. We said, whenever there's a song in this film, let's have the entire song. And also, whenever there's a song in this film, let's have it be absolutely live in the moment, so that you're not pulling the wool over anybody's eyes. You're not putting anybody on. You're playing the song in front of them. so that there isn't this whole idea of playback and, you know, they need mime. So John had this idea for a song, and he really loved the Alanis Morissette song, India. Do you know that song? It goes, God bless, you know, thank you, India, thank you, terror, thank you, disillusion, man. Do you know, he gave us a tape of that song, and he says, I want you to write that song, but I don't want you to, you know, because I he said, I'd love to use that song, but I know I probably wouldn't be allowed, and I want this song, I want all the songs to be original. So the idea was that Mar's character, the batteries would go in her CD player, and that she would basically sing over music that I would have supposedly written, and it was going to be a, you know, John wanted basically just to do a singing in the rain moment where it was a real musical moment. And so we hired a crane, and basically we just walked up the street with Mar that whole evening, and I think it really does work in the film, but that is the one moment where we're miming.
Yeah, but it's also a moment where you get to actually know something about the girl, because I think through the songs that the male character plays, you get to know something about his personality, you know, something that you probably wouldn't get to know about a person in one and a half hour. And so you get that little chance with that song that the girl sings as well, which works very well, I think.
And so let's hear it, if you want me, and this will give us a chance to hear Marketa's voice. This is Glenn Hansard and Marketa Erglova from the soundtrack of their film Once.
Are you really here, or am I dreaming? I can't tell dreams from truth, for it's been so long since I have seen you. I can hardly remember your face anymore, but when I get really low,
If You Want Me from the soundtrack of the film Once. My guest co-wrote the song and also starred in the film. Glenn Hansard and Marketa Erglova are my guests. Since neither of you were really actors when you started making Once, although Glenn, you had a part in The Commitments as a member of the band, did you go seeking advice from people about how to act or how to behave in front of a camera? Did you just learn from doing it? And if you got advice, like, what's the best thing that you were each told that actually helped you?
Well, the thing that I was told, and I can't remember who told me right now, somebody said to me, just remember that Marlon Brando was always Marlon Brando. He wasn't, like, the reason people hired him to be in films is because he was Marlon Brando. I kind of like the idea that no matter what character you're playing, no matter whether you embody it or not. And there are many different styles of acting. Of course, there are many different styles. But this was the thing that I always, that resonated with me most, was the fact that just be yourself and embody the character. And I think that for me, that meant that my range as an actor was probably quite limited. And let's face it, I was pretty much playing myself in this film. I am a street musician. I was a street musician. I fixed bicycles and not Hoovers. John changed that detail, I guess. But when I went to the bank to get my first loan for the frames, the bank manager took out his guitar and played me a song. So there are many details in this guy's life that are very similar to my own. So I guess for myself, it wasn't so difficult to embody this guy. I think if I was given a more challenging role, I might find it a lot more difficult. But I was making this film with Mar, who was a good friend of mine, and also with John Carney, who was in my band, who was a very close friend of mine. So I felt very, very comfortable with these people. It felt like a bunch of friends making a film over the weekend, more than it felt like being involved in a big artistic challenge. You know, the challenge for us was obviously writing the songs and getting them finished. So the acting really took a second place, thank God, in all of this.
I want to play a scene from the beginning of Once. And this is a scene where, Glenn, you're playing on the street for money. But no one's paying any attention to you at all. And until, Marchetta, you walk over and start asking him questions about himself and the music. Here's the scene.
This song you just played, you wrote it?
Working on it.
It's not an established song?
No, it's not an established song.
How come you don't play during daytime? I see you every day.
You know, during the day, people want to hear songs they know, just songs that they recognize. I mean, otherwise, I wouldn't make any money. I play these songs at night. They wouldn't listen.
I listen.
Yeah, but you give me 10 cents.
Well, you do it for money, then? Why don't you get a job in a shop?
I have a job in a shop. Listen, I'm going to get back to this, yeah? Nice to meet you.
Who do you write this song for, please?
No one.
Where is she?
She's gone.
She's dead?
No, she's not dead. She's gone.
You love her still?
Jesus, man.
You're over her. Rubbish. No one wrote this song is over her. I'm telling you. You play this marvelous song to her, you get her back.
I don't want her back.
Glenn Hunsard and Marchetta Erglova in a scene from Once. Glenn, you started out off as a street musician when you were in your teens. You dropped out of high school to play on the streets. Where did you choose to play? Like, what was a good street for you in Dublin?
Well, for me, Grafton Street was the... It was a bit like in Dublin, if you can imagine, if you know, the microcosm of your life, I suppose. For me, I lived on the north side of the city. So Grafton Street was on the south side of the city. And that, for me, made most sense because it meant that I wouldn't bump into anybody from school and that I wouldn't bump into any of my mother's friends or my mother, indeed, because my mother was a fruit seller on Moore Street, which is on the north side of the city. And I wanted to get as far away from anybody I knew as possible. So I went over to Grafton Street. And also Grafton Street was kind of the more posh part of Dublin. So the chances of me having a career or getting beyond just being a street musician, I had better chances, if you like, on the south side of the city, because that's kind of where all the artists lived. And, you know, so I went over there and it was a great, for me, it was the beginning of a whole new education. I mean, I left school at 13. I went over there. The day I left school, I went busking. And what started was I met a man who sold magazines on the street. His name was Pete. And Pete was he prided himself on the fact that he was a Dylanologist. You know, he loved Dylan and loved everything about it. Yeah. And because I was such a Dylan fan, this guy took me seriously because I was playing Dylan songs that weren't necessarily the ones from the greatest hits record. And so this guy was took an interest in me and I guess took me under his wing. And I remember going and living with him for a while. And he took me around to like poetry readings. And pretty much that, from there on, I remember meeting this lady, Philippa Garner, who was a kind of a famous painter in Ireland. And she took me out to her house in Kildare, which was in the countryside. She lived in an old converted schoolhouse that she had rebuilt. And I went and lived with her for 2 years. And really a whole new education began. I remember staying at Seamus Heaney's house when I was a kid and getting to hang out with poets and other musicians was really the basis of my artistic beginnings.
So what's the best thing that happened to you on the streets?
Well, for me, I guess, overall, it was my education. I learned how to sing on Grafton Street. I learned how to entertain. When you're on the street, you're a still point. You know, you're part of the architecture. You're a still. And if you stand still on any street in any city, in any country in the world, if you stand still long enough, every single person in that city will pass you by. So, like, you know, I'd be busking and Van Morrison would walk past as I was singing a Van Morrison song, or, you know, Bono would go by. Or
is that true?
You know,
all, really?
They'd oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so Van Morrison is walking by. What do you do? Do you say, excuse me?
Not at all, no. With someone like Van, you would just give him his space. I mean, and actually, ironically, the reason, I guess, he was passing by was because myself and my friend were busking together and we were singing Van, because Van songs are amazing to busk. So one day we were busking, playing one of his songs, and he passed by. But actually, the irony was that we were busking enough money to go see him that night. So actually, we ended up busking up enough money to go see him. And the same thing happened to us with you too. We were busking up the money to go see them one time, and we saw them the same day, which is very interesting.
Now, Marchetta, you grew up in a family surrounded by music, because your father, correct me if I'm wrong, your father promoted music festivals in Czechoslovakia when you were growing up?
Well, my parents are those kind of people that my father, is constantly searching for finding something that he can be excited about doing. And so he used to be a vice mayor at one point. That was when I was very small. And then he decided to leave that job because the town was too corrupt, and to found his own newspaper so that he could have more of a voice. And so him and my mother have been doing this newspaper, writing the articles for it, and doing that for the past, you know, 15 years. And after that, he kind of, you know, he's got a wine shop because they're both lovers of wine. And beside that, he was kind of taking care of a few bands and organizing gigs for them. So the two of them are very active in their life. You know, they're constantly looking for things to do to be able to get behind. And so one of the things they did get excited about was just kind of having different people coming in and out of their life and having them over at their house. And a lot of those kind of people were musicians. So without him having an official job of a music promoter, that's what he kind of does in a funny way. So yes, music was always a big thing in my house, and there's tons of CDs on the shelves. And I would have been growing up, you know, going to sleep with Joni Mitchell songs and Leonard Cohen songs. So yes, music was always a huge part of my family.
How did you both meet?
Me and Glenn?
Yeah.
Well, it was a case of my father helping a man that lives in Ireland get this Irish band over to Czech Republic and Slovakia for a few gigs. And he was the guy that would kind of help out on the Czech side, because he obviously speaks Czech and English, so he'll be able to communicate and get venues to be helpful. And so he basically helped organize a few gigs that the Frames had around the area. And because he did do that, when the band came over, they just kind of came to our house and we organized a party for them in our garden. And that was where we met, basically around a fire, playing songs and singing along. And my mother cooked this big feast. So we met in a really lovely way, where Glenn my family would basically invite the whole bunch, which was about 12 people, over to the house and befriend Glenn and the band. So then Glenn would just keep coming to the house because of my mother's cooking and stuff. So it's a very funny way of us meeting. But throughout the years, we would have become friends.
So Glenn, when you dropped out of school at the age of, what, 14, so that you could perform on the streets, what did your parents think of that?
Well, I'm very lucky in that my mother was very, very liberal. She grew up in a very, very tight household where she had to be home at a certain time, and that, you know, she had 12 brothers and sisters, and I guess if the family had to keep everybody, herd them together, I guess, if you like. So my mother grew up in the 60s, you know, and so during that time she wanted basically to give her kids the freedom that she never had. So my mother was like very, very liberal. She said to me, anytime you need, you know, if you want to, you know, when I came home to her and said, Ma, I really want to do music, my mother just said, well, do it then. And she said, well, do it, and if you're going to do it properly, so go, you know, go and earn a living from it and do it and getting really involved in it. So I was lucky, and my dad was my dad was one of those guys who was he worked hard, but he was a hard drinking man and supported us in whatever we wanted to do, but didn't really play much of a role in our lives except to say, yeah, fair play to you, son, go for it, you know. So my dad was I guess was on board with it too. I was very, very lucky. I mean, my headmaster in school, my head teacher, he was a great guy. I was in his office so many times. And we talked and talked, and I guess he was a smart guy. He figured out that music was the one subject I really enjoyed talking about. And because he was in his spare time, he was a DJ. And so myself and himself would talk about Dylan and Cohen and Neil Young and all the stuff that really impassioned me. And he basically said to me one day, he called me down to the office and he says, Glenn, you know what? You're in this school, you're not learning a thing, you're frustrating all of the teachers, and I know you love music. So I have an idea. Why don't you go, take your guitar, go over to Grafton Street or go to any street you want, but start your musical career at the very bottom today. He said, you know, go and, you know, take your guitar out. And if in a year you're not enjoying it or it's not working out for you, come back to school and I'll figure out a way of getting you back into class and you can continue your education. He says, but I don't think that your education is going anywhere. He says, you can tell me all the musicians who played on John Wesley Harding, or you can tell me who produced the first two Leonard Cohen records, but you can't tell me the square root of 9. And he says, so you're not really very good to us here, and I'd like to see you succeed. So he sent me home that day to take my guitar and go to the Grafton Street. And when I went home, I said to my mother, I dropped my school bag in the hall and I said to my mother, Ma, I'm gonna start my career as a musician. And my mother was like, what, really? And I was like, yeah. She says, well, go for it, son, and good luck.
Oh, that worked out. And Marquetta, how did your parents feel when you, at the age of 17, took a break from school, left home, went to another country to make a movie?
Well, first of all, like Glenn's parents, my parents are very liberal themselves. So they, you know, it's not like they ever restricted me much in you know, whatever I wanted to do. But I guess there was, you know, they were always concerned ever since Glenn came into my life as a musician who left school at 13. You know, I think they were always concerned that I would just forget about school and try walk in his footsteps. And they were only concerned about that because they wanted me to have something to fall back on in case music didn't work out or something, you know. But at the same time, I think I was always, I always had a very good sense of that if I was quite sensible at home and if I didn't get into too much trouble, then I'd have that freedom because they would trust me and they'd kind of know that I'll be all right on my own. And so I stayed out of trouble and I did all my homework in school. And for that, I had the freedom to travel and miss out on school at times. So it, you know, was great. And they did, and they're, my parents are very supportive, you know, so they would have never kind of stood between me and my dreams or anything like that. So I'm very thankful to them for that.
Now, you know, in the movie, it's clear that you're kind of made for each other, but you're both in or have been in other relationships, and you're kind of headed in different directions, and the relationship doesn't really work out. And I think viewers are really rooting for you to become a couple in the film. I understand that you've become a couple in real life, even though you don't quite make
right.
it in the film. And that must be really interesting for you because people who meet you must and who've seen the movie already have a sense of you as having this like very special connection.
Yeah, that's true. And in a way, I think, because we meet some people and they're like, you know, I was really happy with the way you ended the film. I thought that was really great that it ended this in this way. And then we meet people and they're genuinely angry at us for not having the characters kiss in the end. And so for them, we kind of console them and we're like, well, you know, we're living out the sequel, if you like, and we're together now. So they feel a bit better about themselves then. It's funny.
I want to ask you about another scene from Once. There's a great scene in what I think is a pub. It almost looks like a living room, but I think it's actually like a small pub. And everybody's kind of eating dinner and drinking. And the rule of the game here is that you have to be able to sing to be in on this dinner. And people just kind of alternate singing. And there's a kind of middle-aged woman and a middle-aged man, or slightly older man, who sing a few bars in this sequence. And they have really interesting voices. And I was wondering, like, who are they? And is this based on a real pub in Dublin?
Well, actually, that room is where me and Mara live. That's our flat.
Oh.
And yeah, and because we didn't have money to hire a venue, we decided to have a party in our flat.
No wonder it looks like an apartment. Okay.
Yeah, so that's our place. That's where we live. And also the guy I was telling you about earlier on, the first person I met, the Dylanologist in Grafton Street, that's Pete, and he's the guy who sings.
Oh.
And then the woman who sings is my mother.
No.
Yeah, that's my mother, Catherine. So, and again, how we did it was instead of trying to hire a room and put lots of extras in it, we just threw a party and invited all our friends over and filmed
great.
It.
I really liked her voice. You know, there was something vaguely Marianne Faithful-ish about it.
Yeah. Well, interestingly,
the older Marianne Faithful.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, Marianne Faithful used to live in that flat also, which you might have somehow picked up on. Yeah. We're very lucky in that we live. One of the other people that I met when I was younger was Marina Guinness, who's part of the Guinness family in Ireland. And like, Ireland doesn't have royalty, but if we did have royalty, it would have to be the Guinness family, because they're such a strong and powerful family in Ireland in a very nice way. And of course, we all admire them because we drink their product constantly. It's an amazing thing. So, but I'm really glad you pointed out the guy and the woman, because the guy is the guy I was talking about who took me on board, and I spent a lot of time with him when I was younger, and of course, my mother.
Now we have to play that scene.
Great to see you here. Can you sing? You can't sing, you're out.
There's one request I'll ask of you when your liberty came. Remember Mitchell far away, a convict bound in chains.
My pain that once held this heart of mine.
That's a scene from Once, which stars my guests, Glenn Hansard and Marketa Erglova, who are both musicians and songwriters who are performing together now on tour. Did your mother sing a lot when you were growing up?
Yeah, my mother sang constantly when we were kids, my father. My mother used to win, like, she won a bunch of competitions when we were kids, you know, in pubs. And, you know, they never, my mother, of course, never took singing as seriously as, say, I did. But, you know, and my father, my grandfather was an opera singer, and my grandfather sang, I remember my great-grandfather sang in the same competition as James Joyce and beat him, apparently, in an opera. competition a long, long time ago. So music's definitely been in my family.
So, wow, your lives have just been so changed by the movie. It's just, in every way, in terms of your performances, in terms of the fact that you're now a couple and you're living together. I'm sure you just never expected that.
Not at all. I mean, it's been a very, very serendipitous, I suppose. It's been a very, very interesting and powerful chapter in my life, for sure. And, you know, exactly. It's like, does life imitate art? Does art imitate life? The lines are definitely blurred, and I really like that about it.
Since Dylan figures into your story here, Glenn, particularly your story, I think maybe we'll end with You Ain't Going Nowhere from the soundtrack of the Dylan movie, the movie about Dylan, I'm Not Here, the fictional movie about Dylan. So you recorded You Ain't Going Nowhere for it. Now, I know Dylan was a big influence on you, Glenn. You sang Dylan songs when you were busking as a teenager on the streets. The Frames opened for Dylan on some tour or another, so I imagine you got to meet him.
Yeah.
Did he have much to say? Is he meetable? I mean, is he accessible as a person?
I'm very, very lucky in that I got to spend, you know, some time in Bob's company, and he's one of those men. I don't even feel very comfortable talking about him, because he's just so, for me, he's just a great. And I've been lucky in my life in that I've met all the people that I've really adored. I've somehow managed to meet, and I feel great about that. And so spending a bit of time in a master's company gives one a great sense of humility. And so all I can say is that I definitely wasn't disappointed. I spoke to Bob about Woody Guthrie, and that was, for me, was, you know, what was really great about that was it was two artists speaking about another artist, and that was the best way the conversation could flow, because, you know, what do you say to the man who's heard every different approach? And when I met him, I didn't really know what to say. I guess I was lucky, and what just fell out of my mouth was, I said, meeting you, Bob, is a bit like what it must have been like when you met Woody. And the conversation could have died right there, but it didn't. It went on. And you know, Bob talked about Woody and I talked about Woody. I knew just enough to keep a conversation going with him, you know. So it was, for me, it's been a wonderful experience being in his company.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us, and congratulations on your lives together and on the success of Once and your music. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Glenn Hansard and Marketa Erglova starred in the film Once and wrote and performed the songs in it. The film is on DVD. Hansard and Erglova now perform under the name The Swell Season and are currently on an American tour. After making the films Dirty Pretty Things, Children of Men, Talk to Me, and American Gangster, actor Chiwetel Ejiofor is now starring in David Mamet's new film Red Belt. Although he's been playing Americans, Ejiofor is British. His parents moved to England from Nigeria. In the new film Red Belt, Ejiofor plays a martial arts instructor who teaches and practices self-defense and the larger philosophy of self-control and discipline that goes with it. He's an honest man operating in an often dishonest world where things aren't what they appear to be because, after all, this is a film written and directed by David Mamet. Let's hear a scene from early in the film. Emily Mortimer plays a troubled woman who has accidentally hit the instructor's parked car. After going to his studio to explain, he encourages her to come back to study. Here he is trying to teach her.
The first step is the hardest.
And what is the first step?
To leave the outside outside.
I think I've come to the wrong place. I'm so sorry.
Conquer your fear, and you'll conquer your opponent.
Yes. Mr. Terry, a man raped me. He held a knife to my throat, a man twice my size, and then he raped me.
He held a knife to your throat?
Yes. Look, I appreciate what you've done. It's just that I don't think there's anything I could learn here that would really...
There is no situation that you cannot escape from. There is no situation that you cannot turn to your advantage.
A man was going to cut my throat.
Like this? Oh, no, there's a knife there. There's a knife there. Grab my arm. Drag it toward me. Toward me. Good. Now, move to the right. Move to the right and behind me. Move to the right and behind me. Good. Now, stab me with the knife. Good. Stab me with the knife. Good. Stab me with the knife. Stab me with the knife. Let's hear it. Let it out. Let it out. Let it out. But the fighters.
Chiwetel Ejiofor, welcome back to Fresh Air. I figure you were hoping to work with David Mamet one day.
Yeah, absolutely.
What did he want you to know about your character?
I think he was just very interested, as I was, in learning about the philosophies of jiu-jitsu and of trying to sort of get under the skin of this guy, this character, Mike Terry, by... really approaching the philosophies and lifestyles of Brazilian jiu-jitsu practitioners. And I think some way that was, this was the fundamental dynamic and understanding of the character. So that was what he was really asking me to engage with. And that was a process that continued, you know, through obviously my training in jiu-jitsu and my understanding of the philosophy. And then into the actual shooting of the film.
Did you get to throw David Mamet? Did you get to practice on him?
I actually didn't, but, you know, like anybody who has, you know, any martial arts, I'm sure everybody would sympathize with, when you start doing martial arts, you have a period, and it's sort of about, for me, it was sort of, I think, about 6 weeks in, when I suddenly believed that I was the greatest martial artist. You know exactly five things, and you suddenly think that's going to take you through, you know, absolutely any situation, you know, in on a set, outside a set, anywhere, under any circumstances. And it was on one such occasion that we were waiting for, a lighting change and so on. We were in the academy, we were in the gym, and I said to David, you know, how about it? You know, let's get down, let's work on that. You know, you've been doing it for a few years, I've been doing it for a month and a bit, I feel like I got something going here. And David kicked off his shoes, took off his hat, and got onto the mat. And I as he was approaching me, I remember thinking that he was sort of suddenly encroaching my space a lot, and that he must have made a mistake and got too close, because he was standing on my toe, and I tried to move my foot and then realized I couldn't. And he actually put all his weight on my right foot, and then looked at me and smiled and said, "You see, you know, you've lost already, and because you just can't fight jiu-jitsu with one leg." So it was a way of me learning very quickly that experience counts in jiu-jitsu as in anything else.
So Mamet's a jiu-jitsu guy, huh?
He is. He's been training jiu-jitsu for 6 years.
Oh.
Yeah, and is, I mean, very respected by the guys who are doing it. I mean, he's very good at it.
So was his teacher on the set?
Yeah, Renato Magno, who was there, and he was also training me. And it was that gave David the introduction to the world of jiu-jitsu, and then and that sort of raised the creative juices, and the story sort of flows from there.
So do you think that if you got into a fight, if somebody picked a fight with you, that you would now be better able to defend yourself?
Well, I mean, they'd have to attack me in the correct sequence of moves.
That's right.
And then I would definitely be able to defend myself. But if they varied too much, it would be more complicated for me. But, you know, we went, you know, it takes several years, I think, to be very, very good at these martial arts. And even as I was learning them, you know, Renato Magno, that I was studying with in Los Angeles, was saying that initially, you know, for young people, for, you know, people who are just for novices to it, you know, as well, the when you go out into the ring, if you're competing in a competition, if you remember 10% of your training in the first few bouts, you know, you've done very well, you know. That it takes a long time for these things to become just instinctual and to react with all of your training at your fingertips. So I think it would take me a lot of time, you know, to feel that I had that I was confident in any kind of situation or under any sort of attack.
Now, a couple of years ago, you were in a movie called Kinky Boots, in which you played a drag queen. You seem like one of the more unlikely people to be cast as a drag queen. You're very good in the role. I can imagine people looking at you and thinking, like, "Nah, not possible. Won't make a convincing drag queen."
You know, I don't know. I think people would, you know, there was a sense that, you know, how is this transition going to work? But, you know, the more time that I spent, the more I was aware of what I was going to try and do. And, you know, the more people I met, the more I was aware of, you know, what I was going to try and experiment with and which ways I was going to try and take this. When I got into a place where I could really speak to the wardrobe and makeup and the choreographer and Julian, the director, with, you know, some knowledge and some understanding of the scene. And so I was kind of excited.
I want to play a clip from Kinky Boots. And this is you doing your drag act and you're singing Whatever Lola Wants. Did you make any changes in your voice for the performances as a drag queen?
I think some. I can't remember, really. I think I try to find a different kind of register, a different place, a different attitude, certainly, in my voice, which was interesting.
Well, here you are in Kinky Boots.
Ladies, gentlemen, and those who are yet to make up your mind, whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. And little man, little Lola wants you. Make up your mind to have no regret. Recline yourself, resign yourself, you're through. I always give what I aim for, and your heart and soul is what I came for. Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. Take off your coat, don't you know you can't win? You're no exception to the rule. I'm irresistible, you.
That's Chiwetel Ejiofor as a drag queen in Kinky Boots. What are you wearing in that scene? Do you remember?
I think it was a green sequined dress with 4.5-inch shoes, which were also green. And I can't remember. I think I had a blonde wig.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Chiwetel Ejiofor stars in David Mamet's new film, Red Belt. It opens tomorrow in select cities and widely on May 9th.